The Doctor's Dilemma, a tragedy by Bernard Shaw, with Derek Godfrey, Sarah Burdell, Gary Bond, Stephen Murray, Cyril Luckham, and Hugh Manning. The Doctor's Dilemma.
On the 15th of June, 1903, in the early forenoon, a medical student, surname Redpenny, Christian name unknown and of no importance, sits at work in a doctor's consulting room in Queen Anne Street. Redpenny devils for the doctor by answering his letters, acting as his domestic laboratory assistant, and making himself indispensable generally, in return for unspecified advantages involved by intimate intercourse with a leader of his profession. He is interrupted by an old serving woman, Emmy, who has never known the cares, the preoccupations, the responsibilities, jealousies, and anxieties of personal beauty.
There's a lady bothering me to see the doctor.
Well, she can't see the doctor. What's the use of telling you that the doctor can't take any new patients? When the moment a knock comes at the door, in you bounce to ask whether he can see somebody.
Who asked you whether he could see somebody?
You did.
I said there's a lady bothering me to see the doctor. That isn't asking, it's telling. Have you seen the papers?
No.
Not seen the birthday honours?
Do you suppose I care about the birthday honours? Get out. Dr. Ridgeon will be down before I have these letters ready.
Dr. Ridgeon won't never be down any more, young man.
What?
He's been made a knight. Sir Colenso Ridgeon.
What?
I never was so taken back. I always thought his great discoveries was fudge, let alone the mess of them, with his drops of blood and tubes full of Maltese fever and the like. Now he'll have a rare laugh at me.
Serve you right.
The door knocker will be going all day. Oh, and that reminds me of the poor lady. I think he ought to see her. She's just the kind that puts him in a good temper.
I tell you, he can't see anybody. Do go away, Emmy.
Oh, there goes the bell.
Morning, Emmy.
Now, Dr. Ridgeon, keep yourself tidy and don't go messing about and dirtying your
house. Yes, yes.
The people are coming to congratulate you.
Have you seen the papers? I'll have to alter the name in the letters if you haven't.
Emmy has just told me. I'm awfully glad.
Enough,
I really can't...
young man, enough. You will soon get accustomed to it.
They ought to have done it years ago.
They would have. Only they couldn't stand Emmy opening the door, I dare say.
Dr. Shoemaker.
Do you remember me? Schutzmacher. University College School and Belsize Avenue. Looney Schutzmacher, you know.
What? Looney? Why? I thought you were dead long ago. Sit down. Where have you been these 30 years?
In general practice until a few months ago. I've retired.
I wish I could afford to retire. Was your practice in London?
No.
Fashionable coast practice, I suppose.
How could I afford to buy a fashionable practice? I haven't a rap. I set up in a manufacturing town in the Midlands, in a little surgery, at 10 shillings a week.
And made your fortune?
Well, I'm pretty comfortable. I have a place in Hertfordshire besides our flat in town.
Just rolling in money. I wish you rich GPs would teach me how to make some. What's the secret of it?
Oh, in my case, the secret was simple enough. Though I'm afraid you'll think it rather infradig.
Oh, I have an open mind. What was the secret?
Just two words. Cure guaranteed.
Cure guaranteed?
After all, that's what everybody wants from a doctor, isn't it?
My dear Looney, it was an inspiration. Was it on the brass plate?
There was no brass plate. It was a shop window. Red, you know, with black lettering. Dr. Leo Schutzmacher, LRC, PMRCS. Advice and medicine, sixpence. Cure guaranteed.
And the guarantee proved sound 9 times out of 10, eh?
Oh, much oftener than that. You see, most people get well all right if they're careful and you give them a little sensible advice. And the medicine really did some good. Parrish's chemical food.
Red Penny,
sir?
Make a note of Parrish's chemical food.
Yes, sir.
I take it myself when I feel run down. Goodbye. You don't mind my calling, do you? Just to congratulate you.
Delighted, my dear Looney. Oh, come to lunch Saturday next week.
Oh, delighted. Thank you. Goodbye.
Old Paddy Cullen was here before you were up.
Who taught you to speak of Sir Patrick Cullen as old Paddy Cullen, you young ruffian?
You never called him anything else.
Not now that I'm Sir Colenso. Next thing you fellows will be calling me old Collie Ridgeon.
We do, at St. Anne's.
Ah, that's what makes the medical student the most disgusting figure in modern civilization. No veneration, no
Sir
manners.
Patrick Cullen.
Well, young chap, is your hat too small for you, eh?
Much too small.
I owe it all to you.
Oh, blarney, me boy. Thank you all the same. I've come to talk to you. Young man, get out.
Certainly, Sir Patrick.
That's a good lad. They all put up with me, these young chaps, because I'm an old man. But the world's growing very interesting to me now, Collie.
You keep up your interest in science?
Lord, yes. Modern science, a wonderful thing. Look at your great discovery. Look at all the great discoveries. Where are they leading to? Right back to my poor dear old father's ideas and discoveries. He's been dead now for over 40 years. It's very interesting.
There's nothing like progress, is there?
Don't misunderstand me, me boy. I'm not belittling your discovery. Most discoveries are made regularly every 15 years. And it's fully 150 since yours was made last. That's something to be proud of. But your discovery's not new. It's only inoculation. You've brought us back to inoculation.
I know nothing about smallpox. My line is tuberculosis and typhoid and plague. But, of course, the principle of all vaccines is the same.
Tuberculosis, You've found out how to cure consumption, eh?
I believe so.
Ah, yes. Very interesting. I've known over 30 men that found out how to cure consumption. But why do people go on dying of it, Collie?
You old cynic. You don't believe a bit in my discovery.
No, no. I don't go quite as far as that, Collie. But you remember Jane Marsh, the woman with the tuberculous ulcer under her arm? Hmm?
Oh, your washerwoman's daughter. Was her name Jane Marsh? I forgot.
Hmm. Perhaps you've forgotten also that you undertook to cure her with Cox tuberculin.
And instead of curing her, it rotted her arm right off. Yes, I remember. Poor Jane. However, she makes a good living out of that arm now by showing it at medical lectures.
Still, that wasn't quite what you intended, was it?
I took my chance on it.
Jane, did you mean?
Well, it's always the patient who has to take the chance when an experiment is necessary. And we can find out nothing without experiment.
And what did you find out from Jane's case?
I found out that the inoculation that ought to cure sometimes kills.
Well, I could have told you that. I've tried these modern inoculations a bit myself. I've killed people with them, and I've cured people with them. But I gave them up because I never could tell which I was going to do.
Read this pamphlet next time you have an hour to spare, and you'll find out why.
Oh, bother your pamphlets. Opsonin? Now, what the devil is opsonin?
Opsonin is what you butter the disease germs with to make your white blood corpuscles eat them.
Well, that's not new. I've heard this notion that the white corpuscles... what is it that... What's his name? Metchnikoff calls them.
Phagocytes.
Aye. Phagocytes. Yes, yes, yes. Well, I heard this theory that the phagocytes eat up the disease germs years ago. Long before you came into fashion... Besides, they don't always eat them.
When you butter them with opsonin, they will. My discovery is that the manufacture of that butter, which I call opsonin, goes on in the system by ups and downs. And that what the inoculation does is to stimulate the ups or downs, as the case may be. If we had inoculated Jane Marsh when her butter factory was on the upgrade, we should have cured her. But we got it on the downgrade and lost her arm for her. Everything depends on your inoculating at the right moment. Inoculate when the patient is in the negative phase, and you kill. Inoculate when the patient is in the positive phase, and you cure.
And pray, how are you to know whether the patient is in the positive or the negative phase?
Send a drop of the patient's blood to the laboratory at St. Anne's, and in 15 minutes, I'll give you his opsonin index in figures. My tuberculosis patients don't die, now.
Will you see a lady that wants her husband's lungs cured?
Oh, haven't I told you that I will see nobody? I live in a state of siege ever since it got about that I'm a magician who can cure consumption with a drop of serum. I tell you, Emmy, I can see nobody.
Well, I'll tell her to wait a bit.
You'll tell her I can't see her and send her away, do you hear?
Well, will you see Mr. Cutler Walpole? He don't want to cure you and he wants to congratulate you.
Of course, show him up.
He's talking to the poor lady.
Show him up.
He's a clever operator, is Walpole. Though he's only one of your chloroform surgeons. Your Cutler Walpoles and their like have found out that a man's body is full of bits and scraps of old organs he has no mortal use for. Thanks to chloroform, you can cut half a dozen of them out without leaving him any the worse, except for the illness and the guineas it costs him. I knew the Walpoles well 15 years ago. The father used to snip off the ends of people's uvulas for 50 guineas. His brother-in-law extirpated tonsils for 200 guineas until he took up women's cases at double the fees. Cutler himself worked hard at anatomy to find something fresh to operate on, and at last he got hold of something he calls the nuciform sac, which he's made quite the fashion. People pay him 500 guineas to cut it out. They might as well get their hair cut.
Mr. Cutler Walpole.
My dear Richard, heartiest congratulations. You deserve it.
Thank you.
As a man, mind you deserve it as a man. The obstinate is simple rot, as any capable surgeon can tell you. But we're all delighted to see your personal qualities officially recognized. Sir Patrick, how are you? I sent you a paper lately about a little thing I invented, a new saw for shoulder blades.
Yes, I got it. It's a good saw. Useful, handy instrument.
I knew you'd see its point.
Yes. I remember that saw 65 years ago.
What?
It was called a cabinet maker's jimmy then.
Nonsense. Cabinet maker be...
Never mind him, Walpole. He's jealous.
And how are you?
Well, rather out of sorts. Overwork, I suppose.
I know what's the matter with you. I can see it in your complexion. I can feel it in the grip of your hand.
What is it?
Blood poisoning.
Blood poisoning? Impossible.
I tell you, blood poisoning. Your nuciform sac is full of decaying matter, undigested food and waste products, rank ptomaines. Now, you take my advice, Ridgeon. Let me cut it out for you. You'll be another man afterwards.
Don't you like him as he is?
I don't like any man who hasn't a healthy circulation. In an intelligently governed country, people wouldn't be allowed to go about with nuciform sacs, making themselves centers of infection. The operation ought to be compulsory.
Have you had your own sac removed, may I ask?
I haven't got one. Look at me. I've no symptoms. I'm as sound as a bell. About 5% of the population haven't got any, and I'm one of the 5%.
Sir Ralph Bloomfield Bonington.
Where is he?
Oh, drat him. I thought he was following me. He stayed down to talk to that lady.
I told you to tell that lady.
Oh, by the way, Ridgeon, that reminds me. I've been talking to that poor girl. It's her husband, and she thinks it's a case of consumption, the usual wrong diagnosis. These damned general practitioners ought never to be allowed to touch a patient except under the orders of a consultant. She's been describing the symptoms to me, and the case is as plain as a pikestaff. Bad blood poisoning. Now, she's poor, and she can't afford to have him operated on. Well, you send him to me. I'll do it for nothing. There's room for him in my nursing home. I'll put him straight and feed him up, and make her happy. I like making people happy.
Here he is. Aha!
Sir Colenso, Sir Colenso. Welcome to the Order of Knighthood.
Thank you, B.B.
What, Sir Patrick? And how are we today? A little chilly, a little stiff, but hail and still the cleverest of all. What, Walpole? The absent-minded beggar, eh?
What does that mean?
Have you forgotten the lovely opera singer I sent you to have that growth taken off her vocal cords?
Great heavens, man. You don't mean to say you sent her for a throat operation?
Ah-ha! You removed her nuciform sac. Oh, well, force of habit. Never mind, never mind. She got back her voice after it and thinks you're the greatest surgeon alive. And so you are, so you are, so you are.
Blood poisoning. I see.
And how's a certain distinguished family getting on under your care, Sir Ralph?
Our friend Ridgeon will be delighted to hear that I've tried his obstinate treatment on little Prince Henry with complete success.
But how did...
I suspected typhoid. The head gardener's boy had it. So I just called at St. Anne's one day and got a tube of your very excellent serum. You were out, unfortunately.
I hope they explained to you carefully
Lord
that...
bless you, my dear fellow. I didn't need any explanations. I've handled these antitoxins ever since they first came out.
But they're not antitoxins. And they're dangerous unless you use them at the right time.
Of course they are. Everything is dangerous unless you take it at the right time. An apple at breakfast does you good. An apple at bedtime upsets you for a week. There are only two rules for antitoxins. First, don't be afraid of them. Second, inject them a quarter of an hour before meals 3 times a day.
Great heavens, B.B. No, no, no.
Yes, 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 Collie. The proof of the pudding is in the eating, you know. It acted like magic on the little prince. Up went his temperature, off to bed I packed him, and in a week he was all right again and absolutely immune from typhoid for the rest of his life. The family were very nice about it. Their gratitude was quite touching. But I said they owed it all to you, Ridgeon, and I'm glad to think that your knighthood is the result.
I'm deeply obliged to you.
Not at all, not at all. Your own merit. Come, come, come. Don't give way.
It's nothing. I was a little giddy just now. Overwork, I suppose.
Blood poisoning.
Overwork? There's no such thing. I do the work of 10 men. Am I giddy? No. No. If you're not well, you have a disease. It may be a slight one, but it's a disease. What is the remedy? A very simple one. Find the germ and kill it.
Suppose there's no germ.
Impossible, Sir Patrick. There must be a germ. Else how could the patient be ill?
Can you show me the germ of overwork?
No. But why? Why? Because, my dear Sir Patrick, though the germ is there, it's invisible. These germs, these bacilli, are translucent bodies, like glass, like water. To make them visible, you must stain them. Well, my dear Paddy, do what you will, some of them won't stain. Consequently, though we know as scientific men that they exist, we cannot see them. Science is always simple and always profound. That is why I'm taking up your treatment, Ridgeon, and pushing it. It's scientific.
Dr. Blenkinsop.
Oh, how are you, Blenkinsop?
I've come to offer my humble congratulations. Oh, dear. All the great guns are before me.
How do you do, Blenkinsop? How do you do?
And Sir Patrick, too.
You've met Walpole, of course.
How do you do?
It's the first time I've had that honor. In my poor little practice, there are no chances of meeting you great men. I know nobody but the St. Anne's men of my own day. And so you're Sir Colenso. How does it feel?
Foolish at first. Don't take any notice of it.
I'm ashamed to say I haven't a notion what your great discovery is. But I congratulate you all the same, for the sake of old times.
But, my dear Blenkinsop, you used to be rather keen on science.
Ah, I used to be a lot of things. Well, I used to read the medical papers at first. But you know how soon a man drops that. Besides, I can't afford them. And what are they, after all, but trade papers full of advertisements? Yes, I've forgotten all my science. But I have great experience. And bedside experience is the main thing, isn't it?
Always, provided that you have a sound scientific theory to correlate your observations at the bedside. Mere experience by itself is nothing. If I take my dog to the bedside with me, he sees what I see. But he learns nothing from it. Why? Because he's not a scientific dog.
It amuses me to hear you physicians and general practitioners talking about clinical experience. What do you see at the bedside but the outside of the patients? Well, it isn't his outside that's wrong. Except perhaps in skin cases. What you want is a daily familiarity with people's insides. And that you can only get at the operating table. I know what I'm talking about. I've been a surgeon and consultant for 20 years. And I've never known a general practitioner right in his diagnosis yet. Bring them a perfectly simple case, and they diagnose cancer, and arthritis, and appendicitis, and every other itis, when any really experienced surgeon could see that it is a plain case of blood poisoning.
Ah, it's easy for you gentlemen to talk. But what would you say if you had my practice? Except for the workmen's clubs, my patients are all clerks and shopmen. They daren't be ill. They can't afford it. When they break down, what can I do for them? You can send your people to San Moritz or Egypt or recommend horse exercise or motoring or champagne jelly or complete change and rest for 6 months. I might as well order my people a slice of the moon. And the worst of it is I'm too poor to keep well myself on the cooking I have to put up with. I've such a wretched digestion, and I look it. How am I to inspire confidence?
Oh, don't, Blenkinsop. It's too painful. Oh. The most tragic thing in the world is a sick doctor.
Yes, by George. It's like a bald-headed man trying to sell a hair restorer. Thank God I'm a surgeon.
I am never sick. Never had a day's illness in my life. That's what enables me to sympathize with my patients.
What? You're never ill?
Never.
That's interesting. I believe you have no musiform sack. If you ever do feel at all queer, I should very much like to have a look.
Thank you, my dear fellow, but I'm too busy just now.
I was just telling them when you came in, Blenkinsop, that I've worked myself out of sorts.
Ooh. Well, it seems presumptuous of me to offer a prescription to a great man like you, but still I have great experience. And if I might recommend a pound of ripe greengages every day, half an hour before lunch, I'm sure you'd find the benefit. They're very cheap.
What do you say to that, B.B.?
Very sensible, Blenkinsop. Very sensible indeed. I'm delighted to see that you disapprove of drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, believe me, Paddy, the world would be healthier if every chemist's shop in England were demolished. Look at the papers, full of scandalous advertisements of patent medicines, a huge commercial system of quackery and poison. But whose fault is it? Ours. Ours, I say. We set the example, we spread the superstition. We taught the people to believe in bottles of doctor stuff, and now they buy it at the stores instead of consulting a medical man.
Quite true. I've not prescribed a drug for the last 15 years.
Drugs can only repress symptoms. They cannot eradicate disease. The true remedy for all diseases is nature's remedy. Nature has provided in the white corpuscles, as you call them, Sir Patrick, in the phagocytes, as we call them, a natural means of devouring and destroying all disease germs. There is at bottom only one genuinely scientific treatment for all diseases, and that is to stimulate the phagocytes. Stimulate the phagocytes!
As I sit here, I seem to hear my poor old father talking again.
Your father? But Lord bless my soul, Paddy, your father must have been an older man than you.
Word for word, almost, he said what you say. No more drugs. Nothing but inoculation.
Inoculation? You mean smallpox inoculation?
Yes. In the privacy of our family circle, sir, my father used to declare his belief that smallpox inoculation was good not only for smallpox, but for all fevers.
What? Richard, did you hear that? Sir Patrick, I am more struck by what you have just told me than I can well express. Your father, sir, anticipated a discovery of my own. Listen, Walpole, Blenkinsop, attend one moment. You will all be intensely interested in this. I was put on the track by accident. I had a typhoid case and a tetanus case side by side in the hospital, a beadle and a city missionary. Think what that meant for them, poor fellows. Can a beadle be dignified with typhoid? Can a missionary be eloquent with lockjaw? No, no! Well, I got some typhoid antitoxin from Ridgeon and a tube of Maldooley's antitetanus serum. But the missionary jerked all my things off the table in one of his paroxysms, and in replacing them, I put Ridgeon's tube where Maldooley's ought to have been. The consequence was that I inoculated the typhoid case for tetanus, and the tetanus case for typhoid. Well, they recovered. They recovered! Except for a touch of St. Vitus's dance, the missionary's as well today as ever. And the beadle's 10 times the man he was.
I've known things like that happen. They can't be explained.
Blenkinsop, there is nothing that cannot be explained by science. Think, Sir Patrick. Reflect, Regan. Look at it without prejudice, Walpole. What is the real work of the antitoxin? Simply to stimulate the phagocytes. Very well. But so long as you stimulate the phagocytes, what does it matter which particular sort of serum you use for the purpose? Ha-ha! Hey! You see? You grasp it? That is why Sir Patrick's father found that inoculation cured all fevers. It stimulated the phagocytes.
Mr. Walpole, your motor's come for you, and it's frightening Sir Patrick's horses, so come along quick.
Goodbye, Ridgeon.
Goodbye, and many thanks.
You see my point, Walpole.
He can't wait, Sir Ralph. The carriage will be in the area if he don't come.
I'm coming. There's nothing in your point, B.B. Phagocytosis is pure rot. The cases are all blood poisoning, and the knife is the real remedy. Bye-bye, Sir Paddy. Oh, happy to have met you, Mr. Blenkinsop.
Walpole has no intellect. A mere surgeon, wonderful operator, but after all, what is operating? Only manual labor. Brain remains master of the situation. The nuciform sac is utter nonsense. There's no such organ. It's a mere accidental kink in the membrane occurring in perhaps 2.5% of the population. Of course, I'm glad for Walpole's sake that the operation is fashionable, for he's a dear, good fellow. And after all, as I always tell people, the operation will do them no harm. Indeed, I've known the nervous shake-up and the fortnight in bed do people a lot of good after a hard London season. But it's still a shocking fraud. But I must be toddling. Goodbye, Paddy. Goodbye. Goodbye. Goodbye, my dear Blenkinsop. Goodbye. Goodbye, Bridgen. Don't fret about your health. You know what to do. If your liver is sluggish, a little mercury never does any harm. If you're restless, try bromide. If that doesn't answer, a stimulant, you know, a little phosphorus and strychnine. If you can't sleep, try an all.
But no drugs, Collie. Remember that.
Certainly not. Quite right, Sir Patrick. As temporary expedients, of course, but as treatment, no. Keep away from the chemist's shop, my dear Richard, whatever you do.
I will, and thank you for the knighthood. Goodbye.
By the way, who's your patient?
Who?
Downstairs. Charming woman. Tuberculous husband.
Is she there still?
Oh, come on, Sir Ralph. Your wife's waiting in the carriage.
Goodbye.
Emmy, is that woman there still? If so, tell her once for all that I can't and won't see her, do you hear?
Oh, she ain't in a hurry. She doesn't mind how long she waits.
Well, I must be off, too. Every half hour I spend away from my work costs me 18 pence. Goodbye, Sir Patrick.
Goodbye.
Well, come to lunch with me some day this week, Blenkinsop.
Can't afford it, dear boy. And it would put me off my own foot for a week. Thank you all the same.
Oh. Can I do nothing for you?
Well, if you have an old frock coat to spare... You see, what would be an old one for you would be a new one for me. So remember me the next time you turn out your wardrobe. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Poor chap. So, that's why they made me a knight. And that's the medical profession.
And a very good profession too, my lad. When you know as much as I know of the ignorance and superstition of the patients... You'll wonder that we're half as good as we are.
We're not a profession. We're a conspiracy.
Well, all professions are conspiracies against the laity. And we can't all be geniuses like you. Every fool can get ill, but every fool can't be a good doctor. There are not enough good ones to go round. And for all you know, Bloomfield Bonington kills less people than you do.
Oh, very likely. But he really ought to know the difference between a vaccine and an antitoxin. Stimulate the phagocytes. The vaccine doesn't affect the phagocytes at all. He's all wrong. To put a tube of serum into his hands is murder. Simple murder.
Now, Sir Patrick, how long are you going to keep them horses standing in the draft? Now, be good. Come along.
Oh, very well, very well, very well. Goodbye, Collie.
Goodbye.
Now... Are you going to see that poor thing, or are you...
Oh, I tell you, for the 50th time, I won't see anybody. Send her away.
Oh, I'm tired of being told to send her away. What good will that do her?
Must I get angry with you, Emmy?
Oh, come now. Just see her for a minute to please me. There's a good boy. She's given me half a crown. She thinks it's life and death to her husband for her to see you.
Values her husband's life at half a crown.
Well, it's all she can afford, poor lamb. Besides, she'll put you in a good temper for the day, because it's a good deed to see her.
Well, she hasn't done so badly. For half a crown, she's had a consultation with Sir Ralph Bloomfield Bonington and Cutler Walpole. That's 6 guineas worth to start with. I dare say she's consulted Blenkinsop, too. That's another 18 pence.
Then you'll see her for me, won't you?
Oh, send her up and be hanged. Redpenny!
What is it?
There's a patient coming up. If she hasn't gone in 5 minutes, come in with an urgent call from the hospital for me. You understand?
Righto. Mm.
Mrs. Doobiedad.
Please be seated.
Doctor.
Wait. Before you begin, let me tell you at once that I can do nothing for you. My hands are full. I sent you that message by my old servant. You would not take that answer.
How could I?
You bribed her.
I only...
That doesn't matter. She coaxed me to see you. You must take it from me now that with all the goodwill in the world, I cannot undertake another case.
Doctor, you must save my husband. It is not an ordinary case. He is not like anybody else in the world. Oh, believe me, he is not. I can prove it to you. I have brought some things to show you, and you can save him. The papers say you can.
What's the matter? Tuberculosis?
Yes. His left
yes,
lung...
Yes, you needn't tell me about it.
You can cure him if only you will. It is true, isn't it? Oh, tell me, please.
You are going to be quiet and self-possessed, aren't you?
Yes, I beg your pardon. I know I shouldn't... Oh, please say that you can, and then I shall be all right.
I'm not a curemonger. If you want cures, you must go to the people who sell them. But I have at the hospital 10 tuberculosis patients whose lives I believe I can save.
Oh, thank God.
Wait a moment. My laboratory, my staff, and myself are working at full pressure. The treatment is a new one. It takes time, means, and skill, and there is not enough for another case. Our 10 cases are already chosen cases. Do you understand what I mean by chosen?
Chosen? No, I can't understand.
You must understand. In every single one of those 10 cases, I have had to consider not only whether the man could be saved, but whether he was worth saving. There were 50 cases to choose from, and 40 had to be condemned to death. Some of the 40 had young wives and helpless children. If the hardness of their cases could have saved them, they would have been saved 10 times over. I've no doubt your case is a hard one. I can see the tears in your eyes. I know that you have a torrent of entreaties ready for me the moment I stop speaking, but it's no use. You must go to another doctor. I'm sorry, but that is all I can say. Good morning.
Doctor, look at these. You understand drawings. You have good ones in your waiting room. Look at them. They are his work.
It's no use my looking. Hello. Yes. Yes, this is the real thing. Yes, yes. These are very clever.
You see, don't you, what a genius he is. Mm. You see that he is worth saving. Oh, Doctor, I married him just to help him to begin. And I was useful to him as a model. His drawings of me sold quite quickly.
Have you got one?
Only this. It was the first.
That's a wonderful drawing. Why is it called Jennifer?
My name is Jennifer. I'm Cornish. It's only what you call Guinevere.
Guinevere. Yes. It's really a wonderful drawing. Excuse me, but may I ask, is it for sale? I'll buy it.
Oh, take it. It's my own. He gave it to me. Take them all. Take everything, but save him. You can. You will. You must.
Sir Glenson! Sir Glenson! They just telephoned from the hospital that you're to come instantly. A patient on the point of death. The carriage is waiting.
Oh, nonsense. Get out. What do you mean by interrupting me like this?
But the patient...
It's not just, you see, I'm engaged. Be off.
Yes, sir.
Doctor, one instant only before you go.
Sit down. It's nothing.
But the patient, he said he was dying.
Oh, he's dead by this time. Sit down.
Oh, you, none of you care. You see people die every day. Oh,
nonsense. I told him to come in and say that. I thought I should want to get rid of you.
What?
Oh, don't look so bewildered. There's nobody dying.
My husband is.
Ah, yes. I had forgotten your husband. Mrs. Dubedat, you are asking me to do a very serious thing.
I am asking you to save the life of a great man.
You are asking me to kill another man for his sake. For as surely as I undertake another case, I shall have to hand back one of the old ones to the ordinary treatment. Well, I don't shrink from that. I've had to do it before, and I will do it again. If you can convince me that his life is more important than the worst life that I am now saving. But you must convince me first.
He made those drawings, and they are not the best, nothing like the best. He is young. His whole life is before him. Won't you let me bring him to you? Won't you see for yourself?
Is he well enough to come to a dinner at the Star and Garter at Richmond?
Oh, yes. Why?
I'm inviting all my old friends to a dinner to celebrate my knighthood. You've seen about it in the papers, haven't you?
Oh, yes. That was how I found out about you.
It will be a doctor's dinner. And it was to have been a bachelor's dinner. I'm a bachelor. Now, if you will entertain for me and bring your husband, he will meet me and he will meet some of the most eminent men in my profession. I can put the case to them. And your husband will have to stand or fall by what we think of him. Will you come?
Yes, of course I will come. And may I bring some of his drawings, the really good ones?
Yes. I will let you know the date in the course of tomorrow. Leave me your address.
Thank you again and again. You have made me so happy. I know you will admire him and like him. This is my address.
Thank you.
May I... Is there... Should I... I mean...
What's the matter?
Your fee for this consultation.
Oh, I forgot. Shall we say, a beautiful drawing of his favorite model for the whole treatment, including the cure.
You are very generous, thank you. I know you will cure him.
After dinner, on the terrace at the Star and Garter, Richmond, on a cloudless summer night.
Oh, I am so sorry we have to go. It seems such a shame, this beautiful night. And we have enjoyed ourselves so much.
I don't believe another half hour would do Mr. Dubedat a bit of harm.
Ah, come, Collie, come, none of that. You take your man home, Mrs. Dubedat, and get him to bed before 11.
Yes, bed before 11. Quite right. Sorry to lose you, dear lady, but Sir Patrick's orders are the laws of Tyre and Sidon.
Very well. Louis will be back in a moment. He's showing Dr. Blenkinsop how to work the telephone.
Well, Mrs. Dubedat, we've had a most enjoyable evening.
Delightful.
Most enjoyable.
What did you think of Louis? Or am I wrong to ask?
Wrong? We're all charmed with him.
Delighted.
Most happy to have met him. A privilege, a real privilege.
Sir Patrick, you are uneasy about him.
I admire his drawings greatly, ma'am.
Yes, but I meant...
You shall go away quite happy. He's worth saving. He must and shall be saved.
Mm. Certainly.
There's no real difficulty, if only you know what to do.
Oh, how can I ever thank you? You don't know what I feel.
My dear lady, come.
Don't mind us. Have a good cry.
No, don't cry. Your husband had better not know that we've been talking about him.
Oh, no, of course not. Oh, what a glorious thing it must be to be a doctor.
Oh,
don't laugh. You don't know what you've done for me.
Now, Ginny Gwinnett, motor has come round.
Ah, Mr. Dubedat, may I ask you to do me a favour? Will you sign your name to this menu card under the sketch you made of me?
Yes, and mine too, if you'll be so good.
Certainly.
Won't you sign Dr. Schutzmacher's for him, Louis?
I don't think Dr. Schutzmacher is pleased with his portrait. I'll tear it up.
No. If Looney doesn't want it, I do.
Now then, Mr. Dubedat, you've had enough of the night air. Take him home, Mum.
Yes. Come, Louis.
Never fear, never mind. I'll make that cough all right.
We will stimulate the phagocytes. Good night, Mrs. Dubedat. Good night.
If the phagocytes fail, come to me. I'll put you right.
Good night, Sir Patrick. Happy to have met you.
Good night, Sir Patrick.
Cover yourself well up. Don't think your lungs are made of iron because they're better than his. Good night.
Thank you. Nothing hurts me. Good night.
Delightful couple. Charming woman. Gifted lad. Remarkable talent. Perfect evening. Great success. Interesting case. Capital dinner.
Yeah. I'm so sorry to have left you, Ridgeon, but it was a telephone message from the police. They found half a milkman at our level crossing with a prescription of mine in its pocket. Where's Mr. Dubedat?
Gone.
Gone?
Just this moment, Blenkinsop.
Well, perhaps I could overtake him.
He's in the motorman, miles off. You can't...
No use.
I confess... I was afraid the husband would turn out to be an appalling bounder. But he's almost as charming in his way as she is in hers. And there's no mistake about his being a genius. It's something to have got a case really worth saving. Somebody else will have to go, but it will be easy to find a worse man.
Well, how do you know?
Oh, come, Sir Paddy, no growling.
Do you see anything wrong with Dubedat, B.B.?
Oh, a charming young fellow. Besides, what could be wrong with him?
There are two things that could be wrong with any man. One of them is a tech, the other is a woman.
Ah, cynic.
He's all right as to the tech, for a while at all events. He talked to me quite frankly before dinner as to the pressure of money difficulties on an artist. He says he has no vices and is very economical, but there's one extravagance he can't afford and yet can't resist, and that is dressing his wife prettily. So I said, bang plump out, let me lend you £20 and pay me when your ship comes home. He was really very nice about it. He took it like a man.
But my dear Walpole, he just borrowed £10 from me.
What?
Uh-huh. Well, it was really hardly borrowing, for he said heaven only knew when he could pay me. I couldn't refuse. It appears that Mrs. Dubedat has taken a sort of fancy to me.
No, it was me.
Certainly not. Your name was never mentioned. He's so wrapped up in his work that he has to leave her alone a good deal. And the poor young innocent fellow, he has, of course, no idea of my position or how busy I am, actually wanted me to call occasionally and talk to her.
Exactly what he said to me.
Oh, really, I must say.
Look here, Bridget. This is beginning to look serious.
Well, Blenkinsop, did you catch him?
No. Excuse my running away like that.
Anything the matter?
Oh, no, no, a trifle. It can't be helped. Never mind.
Was it anything about Dubedat?
I can't tell you, Ridgeon, how ashamed I am of dragging my miserable poverty to your dinner after all your kindness. It's not that you won't ask me again, but it's so humiliating.
But what has happened?
Oh, nothing. It's too ridiculous. I had just scraped up 4 shillings for this little outing, and it cost me 1 and 4 pence to get here. Well, Dubedat asked me to lend him 0.5 crown to tip the chambermaid of the room his wife left her wraps in. Oh, he said he only wanted it for 5 minutes, as she had his purse. So, of course, I lent it to him. And he's forgotten to pay me. I've just 2 pence to get back with.
Oh, never mind that.
No, I know what you're going to say, but I won't take it. I've never borrowed a penny, and I never will. No, I'll train it as far as the 2 pence will take me, and I'll tramp the rest.
You'll do the whole distance in my motor. Did he get anything out of you, Mr. Schutzmacher?
No.
You didn't appreciate his drawing, I think.
Oh. Yes, I did. I should have liked very much to have kept the skips and got it autographed.
But why didn't you?
When I joined Dubedat, he said that the Jews were the only people who know anything about art, and that though he had to put up with your Philistine twaddle, as he called it, it was what I said about the drawings that really pleased him. He also said that his wife was greatly struck with my knowledge and that she always admired Jews. Then he asked me to advance him £50 on the security of the drawings.
No,
of course, I couldn't lend money to a stranger like that.
What did he say?
Well, he made a very uncalled for remark about the Jew not understanding the feelings of a gentleman. I must say you Gentiles are very hard to please. You say we are no gentlemen when we lend money, and when we refuse to lend it, you say just the same. I didn't mean to behave badly, as I told him. I might have lent it to him if he had been a Jew himself.
And what did he say to that?
Oh, he began trying to persuade me that he was one of the chosen people. He said he didn't really want £50, that he was only joking, that all he wanted was a couple of sovereigns.
No, no, Mr. Schutzmacher, you invented that last touch. Seriously, now.
No, you can't improve on nature in telling stories about gentlemen like Dubedat.
I beg your pardon, sir.
Yes?
Oh, it's not about the hotel. I should be discharged if I was seen speaking to you, unless you were kind enough to say you call me to ask whether the motor has come back from the station yet.
Has it?
Oh, yes, sir.
Well, what do you want?
Would you mind, sir, giving me the address of the gentleman that was with you at dinner?
Yes, of course, I should mind very much. You have no right to ask.
Yes, sir, I know it looks like that, but what am I to do?
Huh? Well, what's the matter with you?
Oh, nothing, sir. I want the address, that's all.
You mean the young gentleman?
Yes, sir. That went to catch the train with the woman he brought with him.
The woman? Do you mean the lady who dined here, the gentleman's wife?
Don't believe them, sir. She can't be his wife. I'm his wife.
You his wife?
Oh, this is getting perfectly fascinating, Ridgeon.
I could run upstairs and get you my marriage lines in a minute, sir, if you doubt my word. He's Mr. Louis Dubedat, isn't he?
Yes.
Well, sir, you may believe me or not, but I'm the lawful Mrs. Dubedat.
And why aren't you living with your husband?
Oh, we couldn't afford it, sir. I had £30 saved, and we spent it all on our honeymoon in 3 weeks, and a lot more that he borrowed. Then I had to go back into service, and he went to London to get work at his drawings. I never saw nor heard of him again till I caught sight of him from the window going off in the motor with that woman.
Well, that's 2 wives to start with.
Now, upon my soul, I don't want to be uncharitable, but really I'm beginning to suspect that our young friend's rather careless.
Oh, how long will it take a man to find out that he's a damned young blackguard?
Oh, that's severe, Sir Patrick, very severe. Of course, it's bigamy, but still, he's very young.
And she's very pretty. Mr. Walper, may I sponge on you for another of those nice cigarettes of yours?
Certainly. Oh, bother. Well, I say, I recollect now, I passed my cigarette case to Dubedat and he didn't return it.
Oh, dear.
It was a gold one.
Oh, he never thinks about things like that, sir. I'll get it back for you, sir, if you'll tell me where to find him.
Shall I give her the address or not?
Give her your own address, and then we'll see. You'll have to be content with that for the present, my girl. What's your name?
Minnie Tinwell, sir.
Well, you write him a letter to care of this gentleman, and it'll be sent on. And I'll be off with you.
Oh, thank you, sir. I'm sure you wouldn't see me wronged. Thank you.
Yeah. Do you realize, you chaps, that we have promised Mrs. Dubedat to save this fellow's life?
What's the matter with him?
Tuberculosis.
Oh. And can you cure that?
I believe so.
Oh. Then I wish you'd cure me. My right lung is touched, I'm sorry to say.
What? Oh, your lung is going?
My dear Blenkinsop, what do you tell me?
You mustn't neglect this, you know.
No, no, it's no use. I know what you're going to say. I've said it often to others. I can't afford to take care of myself, and there's an end to it. If a fortnight's holiday would save my life, I'd have to die.
I must go. It's been a very pleasant evening, Collie. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
It's time for us all to move. Mr. Walpole, take Blenkinsop home. He's had enough of the open-air cure for tonight. Have you a thick overcoat to wear in the motor, Dr. Blenkinsop?
Oh, they'll give me some brown paper in the hotel, and a few thicknesses of brown paper across the chest are better than any fur coat.
Well, come along.
Yes.
Good night, Collie. You're coming with us, aren't you, B.B.?
Yes, yes, I'm coming. Good night, my dear Ridgeon. Don't let us lose sight of your interesting patient and his very charming wife. We must not judge him too hastily, you know. Good night, Paddy. Bless you, dear old chap. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night.
Well, Mr. Savior of Lives, which is it to be? That honest, decent man, Blenkinsop? Or that rotten blackguard of an artist, eh?
It's not an easy case to judge, is it? Blenkinsop is an honest, decent man. But is he any use? Dubedat's a rotten blackguard. But he's a genuine source of pretty and good and pleasant things.
Oh, what'll he be a source of for that poor, innocent wife of his when she finds him out?
Yes, that's true. A life will be a hell.
And tell me this. Suppose you had this choice put before you. Either to go through life and find all the pictures bad, but all the men and women good, or to go through life and find all the pictures good and all the men and women rotten. Which would you choose?
It would be simpler if Blenkinsop could paint Dubedat's pictures.
Be simpler still if Dubedat had some of Blenkinsop's honesty. The world isn't going to be made simple for you, my lad. You must take it as it is. You've to hold the scales between Blenkinsop and Dubedat.
Hold them fairly. Well, I'll be as fair as I can. I'll put into one scale all the pounds Dubedat has borrowed, and into the other all the half-crowns that Blenkinsop hasn't borrowed.
And you'll take out of Dubedat's scale all the faith he has destroyed and the honour he has lost, and you'll put into Blenkinsop's scale all the faith he has justified and the honour he has created.
I'm not at all convinced that the world wouldn't be a better world if everybody behaved as Dubedat does, and it is now that everybody behaves as Blenkinsop does.
Then why don't you behave as Dubedat does?
Ah, that beats me. Still, it's a dilemma. You see, there's a complication we haven't mentioned.
What's that?
If I let Blenkinsop die, at least nobody can say I did it because I wanted to marry his widow.
Huh?
Now, if I let Dubedat die, I'll marry his widow.
Perhaps he won't have you, you know.
I know when a woman is interested in me. She is.
Ah. You'd much better cure them both.
I can't. I can squeeze in one more case, but not two.
I must choose.
Well, to me, it's a plain choice between a man and a lot of pictures.
It's easier to replace a dead man than a good picture.
Now, Collie, when you live in an age that runs to pictures and statues and plays and brass bands because its men and women are not good enough to comfort its poor, aching soul, you should thank Providence that you belong to a profession which is a high and great profession, because its business is to heal and mend men and
women. In short, as a member of a high and great profession, I'm to kill my
patient. Now, you can't kill him. But you can leave him in other hands.
In BB's, for instance, eh?
Sir Ralph Bloomfield Bonington is a very eminent physician.
He is.
I'm going for my hat.
Dubedat's studio. Louis, in a milkman's smock, much smudged with colours, is painting his wife, who is appealing to him very anxiously.
Promise, Louis?
I promise, my darling.
When you want money, you will always come to me.
Oh, but it's so sordid, dearest. I can't keep always bothering you for money, money. It's what drives me sometimes to ask other people, though I hate doing it.
It's far better to ask me, dear. It gives people a wrong idea of you.
But I want to spare your little fortune and raise money on my own work. I shall have a one-man show next season, and then there will be no more money troubles. There. Mustn't do any more on that until it's bone dry.
Now, dear, won't you finish those drawings for MacLean?
Hmm? Oh, they don't matter. I've got nearly all the money from him in advance.
But, dearest, that is just why you should finish them. He asked me the other day whether you really intended to.
What the devil does he take me for? I have a good mind to throw up his commission and pay him back the money.
We can't afford that, dear. You had better finish the drawings and have done with them. I think it is a mistake to accept money in advance.
But how are we to live?
Well, Louis, it is getting hard enough as it is, now that they are all refusing to pay except on delivery.
Oh, damn those fellows. They think of nothing and care for nothing but their wretched money.
Still, they ought to have what they pay for.
Oh, there now. That's enough lecturing for today. I've promised to be good, haven't I?
You know that I hate lecturing and that I don't for a moment misunderstand you, dear, don't you?
I know, I know. I'm a wretch and you're an angel.
There. Now, remember the doctors are coming this morning. Isn't it extraordinarily kind of them, Louis, to insist on coming, all of them, to consult about you?
Oh, I dare say they think it'll be a feather in their cap to cure a rising young artist. They wouldn't come if it didn't amuse them anyhow. Say, it's not time yet, is it?
No, not quite yet.
Hello, Richard. Delighted to see you. Come in.
It's so good of you to come, Doctor.
Oh, excuse this place, won't you? It's only a studio, you know. There's no real convenience for living here. But we pick along somehow, thanks to Jennifer.
Now I'll run away. Perhaps later on, when you're finished with Louis, I may come in and hear the verdict.
I say, don't look so grave, Richard. There's nothing awful going to happen, is there?
No.
No, poor Jennifer's been looking forward to your visit more than you can imagine. She's taken quite a fancy to you. There's a sketch I made of her yesterday.
She showed it to me a fortnight ago when she first called on me.
Oh, did she? Good Lord, how time does fly. I could have sworn I'd only just finished it. You know, it's hard for her here, seeing me piling up drawings and nothing coming in for them.
I understood that Mrs. Dubedat had some property of her own.
Oh, yes, a little. But how could a man with any decency of feeling touch that? I suppose I did. What would she have to live on if I died? I'm not insured. I can't afford the premiums. How do you like this one?
I have not come here to look at your drawings. I have more serious and pressing business with you.
Oh, you want to sound my wretched lung. My dear Richard, I'll be frank with you. What's the matter in this house isn't lungs but bills. You've made us feel that we can treat you as a friend. Will you lend us £150?
No.
Why not?
I am not a rich man, and I want every penny I can spare and more for my researches.
You mean you'd want the money back again?
People sometimes have that in view when they lend money.
Well, I'll give you a check. Or see here, there's no reason why you shouldn't have your bit, too. I'll give you a check for 200.
Why not cash the check at once without troubling me?
Bless you, they wouldn't cash it. I'm overdrawn as it is. No, the way to work it is this. I'll post-date the check next October.
In October, Jennifer's dividends come in. Well, you present the cheque. It'll be return marked, refer to draw, some rubbish of that sort. Then you can take it to Jennifer and hint that if the cheque isn't taken up at once, I shall be put in prison. Well, she'll pay you like a shot. I mean, you'll clear £50 and you'll do me a real service.
You see no objection to the transaction?
What objection can there be? It's quite safe. I can convince you about the dividends.
I mean, on the score of its being, shall I say, dishonourable.
Well, of course, I shouldn't suggest it if I didn't want the money.
Indeed. Well, you will have to find some other way of getting it.
Do you mean to say you refuse?
Do I mean... Of course I refuse, man. What do you take me for? How dare you make such a proposal to me?
Why not?
Oh, you would not understand me if I tried to explain. Now, once for all, I will not lend you a farthing.
Excuse me. Come in, Sir Ralph. Good morning, Sir Patrick. Mr. Walpole.
Walpole. I've been here hardly 10 minutes, and already he's tried to borrow £150 from me. Then he proposed that I should get the money for him by blackmailing his wife.
Well, Richard, if that is what you call being an honourable man, I spoke to you in confidence.
We're all going to speak to you in confidence, young man.
We shall make ourselves at home for half an hour, Dubedat. Don't be alarmed. You're a most fascinating chap, and we love you.
Oh, all right, all right. Sit down. Anywhere you can.
By the way, I'll trouble you for my cigarette case, if you don't mind.
What cigarette case?
The gold one I lent you at the Star and Garter.
Was that yours?
Yes.
I'm awfully sorry, old chap. I wondered whose it was. I'm sorry to say this is all that's left of it.
A pawn ticket?
It's quite safe. He can't sell it for a year, you know. I say, my dear Wopple, I am sorry.
Don't mention it. It adds to your fascination.
Before we go any further, you have a debt to pay, Mr. Dubedat.
I have a precious lot of debts to pay, Richard.
It's a small one, and pay it you must and shall. I don't so much mind you borrowing £10 from one of my guests and £20 from the other.
I walked into it, you know. I offered it.
They could afford it. But to clean poor Blenkinsop out of his last half-crown was damnable. I'll have that out of you at all events.
Quite right, Richard, quite right. Come, young man, pay up.
Oh, you needn't make such a fuss about it. Of course I'll pay. I'm as shocked as any of you. Here you are. Oh, I say, I haven't any money on me. Walpole, would you mind lending me half a crown?
Lend you half?
Well, if you don't, Blenkinsop won't get it, for I haven't a rap. You may search my pockets.
That's conclusive. Here.
Oh, I'm really glad that's settled. It was the only thing that was on my conscience. Now I hope you're all satisfied.
Not quite, Mr. Dubedat. Do you happen to know a young woman named Minnie Tinwell?
Minnie? I should think I do, and Minnie knows me too. And she's a really nice, good girl, considering her station. What's become of her?
It's no use bluffing, Dubedat. We've seen Minnie's marriage lines.
Indeed. Have you seen Jennifer's?
Do you dare insinuate that Mrs. Dubedat is living with you without being married to you?
Why not?
Why not?
Yes, lots of people do it. Just as good as people as you. Why didn't you learn to think instead of bleating and baaing like a lot of sheep when you come up against anything you're not accustomed to? I say, I should like to draw the lot of you now. You do look jolly foolish. Especially you, Ridgeon. I had you that time, you know.
Oh, great.
Well, you set up to appreciate Jennifer, you know, and you despise me, don't you?
I loathe you.
Just so. And yet you believe that Jennifer is a bad lot because you think I told you so.
Were you lying?
No. I only asked you had you seen Jennifer's marriage lines, and you concluded straight away that she hadn't got any. You don't know a lady when you see one.
What do you mean by that, may I ask?
Now, I'm only an immoral artist. But if you had told me that Jennifer wasn't married, I'd have had the gentlemanly feeling and artistic instinct to say that she carried her marriage certificate in her face and in her character. But you are all moral men, and morality consists of suspecting other people of not being legally married. Aren't you ashamed of yourselves? Can one of you look me in the face after it?
It's very hard to look you in the face, Dubedat. You have such a dazzling cheek. What about Minnie Tinwell, eh?
Minnie Tinwell is a young woman who has had 3 weeks of glorious happiness in her poor little life, which is more than most girls in her position get, I can tell you. But ask her whether she'd take it back if she could. She's got her name into history, that girl. My little sketches of her will be fought for by collectors. She'll have a page in my biography. What have you fellas done for her compared with that?
We haven't trapped her into a mock marriage and deserted her.
No, you wouldn't have the pluck. Oh, but don't fuss yourselves. I didn't desert little Minnie. We spent all our money...
All her money.
£30.
I said all our money, hers and mine too. Her £30 didn't last 3 days. I had to borrow four times as much to spend on her. But I didn't grudge it, and she didn't grudge her few pounds either. When we were cleaned out, we'd had enough of it. We just said, well, the money's gone. We've had a good time that can never be taken from us. So kiss, part good friends, and she back to service, and I back to my studio, and Jennifer, both the better and happy.
You would know how very seldom an actual case bears out a principle. In medical practice, a man may die when, scientifically speaking, he ought to have lived. I have actually known a man die of a disease from which he was, scientifically speaking, immune. But that does not affect the fundamental truth of science. In just the same way, in moral cases, a man's behavior may be quite harmless and even beneficial when he is morally behaving like a scoundrel, and he may do great harm when he is morally acting on the highest principles. But that does not affect the fundamental truth of morality.
And it doesn't affect the criminal law on the subject of bigamy.
Oh, bigamy, bigamy, bigamy. What a fascination anything connected with the police has for you all. You moralists. I've proved to you that you were utterly wrong on the moral point. Now I'm going to show you that you are utterly wrong on the legal point. And I hope it will be a lesson to you not to be so jolly cocksure next time.
Rot. You were married already when you married her, and that settles it.
Does it? How do you know she wasn't married already, too?
Well, Richard!
She was married to the steward of a liner. He cleared out and left her. And she thought, poor girl, that it was the law, that if you hadn't heard of your husband for 3 years, you might marry again.
Did you tell her you were already married?
Of course not. But don't you see that if she had known, she wouldn't have considered herself my wife? Oh, you don't seem to understand somehow.
You let her risk imprisonment in her ignorance of the law?
Well, I risked imprisonment for her sake. I could have been had up for it just as much as she. But when a man makes a sacrifice of that sort for a woman, he doesn't go and brag about it to her. At least not if he's a gentleman.
What are we going to do with this Daisy?
Oh, go and do whatever the devil you please. Put Minnie in prison, put me in prison, kill Jennifer with the disgrace of it all, and then when you've done all the mischief you can, go to church and feel good about it.
He's got us. He has.
But is he to be allowed to defy the criminal law of the land?
Criminal law is no use to decent people. It only helps blackguards to blackmail their families.
But at least it will punish him.
Oh, yes, it'll punish him. It'll punish not only him, but everybody connected with him, innocent and guilty alike. It'll throw his board and lodging on our rates and taxes for a couple of years, and then turn him loose on us a more dangerous blackguard than ever. It'll put the girl in prison and ruin her. It'll lay his wife's life waste. You may put the criminal law out of your head once and for all. It's only fit for fools and savages.
Would you mind turning your face a little more this way, Sir Patrick?
You put down your pencil, foolish man. Think of your position. You can defy the laws made by men, but there are other laws to reckon with. Do you know that you're going to die?
We're all going to die, aren't we?
We're not all going to die in 6 months.
How do you know?
Upon my soul, I will not stand this. It is in questionable taste under any circumstances or in any company to harp on the subject of death. But it is a dastardly advantage to take of a medical man. I will not allow it, you hear?
Well, I didn't begin it. You chaps did. It's always the way with inartistic professions. When they're beaten in argument, they fall back on intimidation. I never knew a lawyer yet who didn't threaten to put me in prison sooner or later. I never knew a parson who didn't threaten me with damnation, and now you threaten me with death. With all your talk, you've only one real trump in your hand, and that's intimidation. Well, I'm not a coward, so it's no use with me.
I'll tell you what you are, sir. You're a scoundrel.
Oh, I don't mind you calling me a scoundrel a bit. It's only a word you don't know the meaning of. What is a scoundrel?
You are a scoundrel.
Just so, what is a scoundrel? I am, what am I, a scoundrel? It's just arguing in a circle. And you imagine that you're a man of science.
I have a good mind to take you by the scruff of your neck, you infamous rascal, and give you a sound thrashing.
Oh, I wish you would. You'd pay me something handsome to keep it out of court afterwards. Well, have you any more civilities to address to me in my own house? I should like to get them over before my wife comes back.
My mind's made up. When the law breaks down, honest men must find a remedy for themselves. I will not lift a finger to save this reptile.
That is the word I was trying to remember. Reptile.
I can't help rather liking you, Dubedat. But you certainly are a thoroughgoing specimen. You know our opinion of you now, at all events. We can do nothing for you. Good afternoon to you.
Oh, don't get up, Sir Patrick. Don't go. Please don't. Oh, do sit down again. Give me another chance. 2 minutes more. That's all I ask. Thanks awfully.
I don't mind giving you 2 minutes more, but don't address yourself to me, for I've retired from practice, and I don't pretend to be able to cure your complaint. Your life is in the hands of these gentlemen.
Not in mine. I have no time and no means available for this case.
Well, what do you say, Mr. Walpole?
Oh, I'll take him in hand. I feel perfectly convinced that this is not a moral case at all. It's a physical one. There's something abnormal about his brain. That means probably some morbid condition affecting the spinal cord, and that means the circulation. In short, it's clear to me that he's suffering from an obscure form of blood poisoning, which is almost certainly due to an accumulation of ptomaines in the nuciform sac. I'll remove the sac.
You mean operate on me? No, thank you.
You won't feel anything. You'll be under an anesthetic, of course. And it'll be extraordinarily interesting.
Oh, well, if it would interest you and if it won't hurt, that's another matter. How much will you give me to let you do it?
How much? What do you mean?
Well, you don't expect me to let you cut me up for nothing, do you?
Will you paint my portrait for nothing?
No, but I'll give you the portrait when it's painted, and you can sell it afterwards for perhaps double the money. But I can't sell my nuciform sac when you've cut it out.
You can keep your nuciform sac, and your tubercular lung, and your diseased brain. I've done with you.
Oh, that leaves only one medical man who has not withdrawn from your case, Mr. Dubedat. You have nobody left to appeal to now but Sir Ralph Bloomfield Bonington.
My weakness is that I have never been able to say no, even to the most thoroughly undeserving people. Besides, I am bound to say that I don't think it is possible in medical practice to go into the question of the value of the lives we save. Just consider, Ridgeon. Let me put it to you, Paddy. Clear your mind of cant, Walpole.
My mind is perfectly clear of cant.
Quite so. Well, now, look at my practice. It is what I suppose you would call a fashionable practice, a practice among the best people. You ask me to go into the question of whether my patients are of any use either to themselves or anyone else. Well, if you apply any scientific test known to me, you will be driven to the conclusion that the majority of them would be better dead. If I were to stop to argue about their merits, I should have to give up 3/4 of my practice. Therefore, I have made it a rule not so to argue. Now, as an honorable man, having made that rule as to paying patients, can I make an exception as to a patient who, far from being a paying patient, may more fitly be described as a borrowing patient? No. I say no. Mr. Dubedat, your moral character is nothing to me. I look at you from a purely scientific point of view. To me, you are simply a field of battle in which an invading army of tubercle bacilli struggles with a patriotic force of phagocytes. Having made a promise to your wife, which my principles will not allow me to break, to stimulate those phagocytes, I will stimulate them. And I take no further responsibility.
Well, Mr. Dubedat, as Sir Ralph has very kindly offered to take charge of your case, and as the 2 minutes I promised you are up, I must ask you to excuse me.
Oh, certainly, I've quite done with you. There. While you've been talking, I've been doing. Look at that.
You young rascal, was it drawing me you were?
Of course, what else?
That's rather good. Don't you think so, Collie?
Yes. So good that I should like to have it.
Thank you, but I should like to have it myself. What do you think, Walpole?
No, by Jove, I must have this.
I wish I could afford to give it to you, Sir Patrick, but I'd pay 5 guineas sooner than part with it.
I'll give you 6 for it.
10.
I think Sir Patrick is morally entitled to it. May I send it to your house, Sir Patrick, for 12 guineas?
12 guineas? Not if you were president of the Royal Academy, young man.
Would you like to take it at 12, Sir Ralph?
12 guineas. Thank you, I'll take it at that. Accept it from me, Paddy, and may you long be spared to contemplate it.
Oh, thank you.
I needn't settle with you now, Mr. Dubedat. My fees will come to more than that.
Well, of all the mean... I'd sooner let myself be shot than do a thing like that. I consider you've stolen that drawing.
So, we've converted you to a belief in morality after all, eh?
Oh. I'll do another one for you, Walpole, if you'll let me have the 10 you promised.
Very good. I'll pay on delivery.
What do you take me for? Have you no confidence in my honor?
None whatever.
Oh, well, of course, if you feel that way, you can't help it. But before you go, let me fetch Jennifer. I know she'd like to see you, but before she comes in, one word. You've all been talking pretty freely about me, in my own house, too. I don't mind that. I'm a man and can take care of myself. But when Jennifer comes in, please remember that she's a lady and that you are supposed to be gentlemen.
Well, damn his impudence.
I shouldn't be at all surprised to learn that he's well connected. Whenever I meet dignity and self-possession without any discoverable basis, I diagnose good family.
Diagnose artistic genius, B.B. That's what saves his self-respect.
The world is made like that. The decent fellow's always being lectured and put out of countenance by the snobs.
I am not out of countenance. I should like, by Jupiter, to see the man who could put me out of countenance. Ah, Mrs. Dubedat, and how are we today?
Thank you all so much for coming. Since Richmond, I have not known a moment's fear. Won't you sit down and tell me the result of the consultation?
I'll go, if you don't mind, Mrs. Dubedat. I have an appointment. Before I go, let me say that I'm quite agreed with my colleagues here as to the character of the case. As to the cause and the remedy, I may have my own views. In fact, I have them. If I'm needed, and needed I shall be, finally, they know where to find me. So for today, goodbye.
I'll also ask you to excuse me, Mrs. Dubedat. As you know, ma'am, I'm not in practice now, and I shall not be in charge of the case. It rests between Sir Colenso Ridgeon and Sir Ralph Bloomfield Bonington. They know my opinion. Good afternoon to you, ma'am.
Now, Mrs. Dubedat, if I am to take the patient in hand...
You? But I thought that Sir Colenso...
My dear lady, your husband shall have me.
But...
Not a word. It is a pleasure to me for your sake. Sir Colenso will be in his proper place, the laboratory. I shall be in my proper place at the bedside. Your husband shall be treated exactly as if he were a member of the royal family.
Forgive me,
no
but...
No gratitude. It would embarrass me, I assure you. We shall begin by stimulating the phagocytes on Tuesday next, but I will let you know. Depend on me. Don't fret. Eat regularly. Sleep well. Keep your spirits up. Keep the patient cheerful. Hope for the best. No tonic like a charming woman. No medicine like cheerfulness. No resource like science. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye.
You look quite discouraged again. What's the matter? Are you disappointed?
I know I ought to be very grateful, but...
Well?
I had set my heart on your curing, Louis.
Well... Sir Ralph Bloomfield Bonington
is...
Yes,
I know. It is a great privilege to have him, but I wish it had been you. I had such a strong instinct that you would cure him. I can't feel the same about Sir Ralph. You promised me. Why did you give Louis up?
I explained. I cannot take another case.
But at Richmond...
At Richmond, I thought I could make room for one more case, but my old friend, Dr. Blenkinsop's lung, is attacked.
Do you mean that rather silly?
I mean the gentleman that dined with us. An excellent and honest man, whose life is as valuable as anyone else's. I have arranged that I shall take his case.
I see what it is. Why does everybody turn against him? Can you not forgive him for being superior to you? For being cleverer, for being braver, for being a great artist?
Yes, I can forgive him all that.
I have challenged everyone who has turned against him, challenged them face to face to tell me any wrong thing he has done. They have always confessed that they could not tell me one. I challenge you now. What do you accuse him of?
I am like the rest. Face to face, I cannot tell you one thing against him.
But your manner is changed, and you have broken your promise to make room for him as your patient.
You have had the very best medical advice in London for him. And his case has been taken in hand by a leader of the profession.
But I have faith in you, and I have no faith in the others. I must tell you the whole truth. I know Louis as nobody else in the world knows him or ever can know him. I know he has little faults. I know that he sometimes shocks people about money because he is so utterly above it and can't understand the value ordinary people set on it. Tell me, did he borrow any money from you?
He asked me for some once.
Oh, I'm so sorry. So sorry. But he will never do it again. He has given me his promise. Here in this room, just before you came.
Indeed.
I had many dreams as a girl. But at last they all came to one dream. I didn't want to waste myself. I knew that men of genius always had a terrible struggle with poverty and neglect at first. My dream was to save one of them from that and bring some charm and happiness into his life. I prayed heaven to send me one. I firmly believe that Louis was guided to me in answer to my prayer. He came to me like a child. Only fancy, Doctor. He never even wanted to marry me. I had to propose it myself. Then he said he had no money. When I told him I had some, he said, "Oh, all right, just like a boy." He is still like that, quite unspoiled. A man in his thoughts, a great poet and artist in his dreams, and a child in his ways. I gave him myself and all that I had that he might grow to his full height. If I lost faith in him, it would mean the wreck and failure of my life. You must cure him. You must make him quite well again for me. I know that you can do it and that nobody else can. Take Louis yourself and let Sir Ralph cure Dr. Blenkinsop.
Mrs. Dubedat, do you really believe in my knowledge and skill as you say you do?
Absolutely.
Well, will you believe me when I tell you that I understand what you have just told me, that I have no desire but to serve you in the most faithful friendship, and that your hero must be preserved to you?
Oh, forgive me. Forgive what I said. You will preserve him to me.
You must believe me when I tell you that the one chance of preserving the hero lies in Louis being in the care of Sir Ralph.
You say so. I have no more doubt. I believe you. Thank you.
Goodbye. I hope this will be a lasting friendship.
My friendships end only with death.
Death ends everything, doesn't it? Goodbye.
Dubedat's studio, some days later.
What's the matter? Have you been sent for too, Walpole?
We've all been sent for. I haven't seen him yet. The charwoman says that old Paddy Cullen has been here with B.B. for the last half hour. Well, what's up, Paddy?
Go in and see. B.B.'s with him.
What has happened?
Do you remember Jane Marsh's arm?
Is that what's happened?
His lung has gone like Jane's arm. I never saw such a case. He's got through 3 months galloping consumption in 3 days.
B.B. got in on the negative phase.
Negative or positive, the lad's done for. He won't last out the afternoon. He'll go suddenly. I've often seen it.
So long as he goes before his wife finds him out, I don't care. I fully expected this.
It's a little hard on the lad to be killed because his wife has too high an opinion of him. Fortunately, few of us are in any danger of that.
Ah, here you are, Ridgeon. Paddy's told you, of course.
Yes.
It's an enormously interesting case. You know, Collie, by Jupiter, if I didn't know as a matter of scientific fact that I'd been stimulating the phagocytes, I should say I'd been stimulating other things. What is the explanation, Sir Patrick? How do you account for it, Ridgeon? Have we overstimulated the phagocytes?
B.B., you've done it this time.
What do you mean?
Killed him. The worst case of neglected blood poisoning I ever saw. It's too late now to do anything. He'd die under the anesthetic.
Killed? Really, Walpole?
Now, come, come. When you've both killed as many people as I have, you'll feel humble enough about it. Come and look at him, Collie.
Very well.
I apologize, B.B., but it's blood poisoning.
My dear Walpole, everything is blood poisoning. But upon my soul, I shall not use any of that stuff of Ridgeon's again. What made me so sensitive about what you said just now is that, strictly between ourselves, Ridgeon has cooked our young friend's goose.
Sir Ralph, what am I to do? A paragraph appeared in the paper this morning saying that Louis is seriously ill, and this man wants to interview him about it. How can people be so callous?
You just leave me to deal with him.
But Louis insists on seeing him. He almost began to cry about it, and he says he can't bear his room any longer. He says he wants to die in his studio. Sir Patrick says let him have his way. It can do no harm. What shall we do?
Why, follow Sir Patrick's excellent advice, of course. As he says, it can do him no harm, and it will no doubt do him good. A great deal of good.
Will you bring the man up here, Mr. Walpole, and tell him that he may see Louis, but that he mustn't exhaust him by talking?
Leave it to me.
Sir Ralph, don't be angry with me. But Louis will die if he stays here. I must take him to Cornwall.
Cornwall, the very place for him. Wonderful for the lungs. Stupid of me not to think of it before. You are his best physician, after all, dear lady.
You are so kind, Sir Ralph. But don't give me much hope, or I shall cry. And Louis can't bear that.
Then let us help to carry him in.
Yes, indeed.
Cornwall, of course, of course. Very thin.
This is the studio, I suppose.
Yes.
Where he has his models, eh?
No doubt.
Are you one of the family or the doctor?
I'm neither one nor the other. I am Mr. Cutler Walpole. Hmm. Put that down. Yeah. Then put down Sir Colenso Ridgeon.
A pigeon?
Ridgeon. Oh, yeah, you had better let me write the names for you. You're sure to get them wrong. That comes of belonging to an illiterate profession with no qualifications and no public register.
Oh, I say, you have got your knife into us, haven't you?
I wish I had. I'd make a better man of you. Now, Ted, these are the names of the three doctors.
Hmm?
This is the patient.
Ah.
This is the address.
Huh?
This is the name of the disease.
Oh.
Now, Mr. Dubedat will be brought in here presently. He wants to see you because he doesn't know how bad he is. We'll allow you to wait a few moments to humour him. But if you talk to him, out you go. He may die at any moment.
Is he as bad as that? I say I am in luck today.
This is happiness. To be in a studio. Happiness.
Yes, dear. Sir Patrick says you may stay here as long as you like.
Jennifer.
Yes, my dear.
Is the newspaper man here?
Yes, Mr. Dubedat. I'm here at your service. I thought you might like to let us have a few words about... well, a few words on your illness and your plans for the season.
My plans for the season are very simple. I'm going to die.
Louis, dearest.
My darling, I'm very weak and tired. Don't put on me the horrible strain of pretending that I don't know. I've been lying there listening to the doctors, laughing to myself. They know. Dearest, don't cry. It makes you ugly, and I can't bear that. I want you to promise me something.
You know I will.
If there's one thing I hate more than another, it's a widow. Promise me you'll never be a widow.
My dear, what do you mean?
I want you to look beautiful. I want people to see in your eyes that you were married to me. It has been heaven, hasn't it, darling? Sometimes.
Oh, yes, yes. I never lived until I knew you.
Then you must always wear beautiful dresses and splendid magic jewels. Think of all the wonderful pictures that I shall never paint. Well, you must be transfigured with all the beauty of those pictures. Men must get such dreams from seeing you as they never could get from any daubing with paints and brushes. Painters must paint you as they never painted any mortal woman before. There must be a great tradition of beauty, a great atmosphere of wonder and romance. That is what men must always think of when they think of me. That is the sort of immortality I want. You can make that for me, Jennifer. There are lots of things you don't understand that every woman in the world understands, but you can understand that and do it, as nobody else can. Promise me that immortality. Promise me you will not make a little hell of crepe and crying and undertaker's horrors and withering flowers and all that vulgar rubbish.
I promise. But all that is far off, dear. You are to come to Cornwall with me and get well. Sir Ralph says so.
Poor old B.B.
Poor fellow. Brain going.
And Sir Patrick's there, isn't he?
Yes, yes. I'm here.
Sit down, won't you? It's a shame to keep you standing about.
Yes, yes. Thank you. All right.
Jennifer.
Yes, dear.
Do you remember the burning bush?
Yes, yes.
Tell them about it.
It was nothing. Only that once in my old Cornish home we lit the first fire of the winter. Mm. And when we looked through the window we saw the flames dancing in a bush in the garden.
Such a colour! Garnet! Waving like silk. Liquid, lovely flame flowing up through the bay leaves and not burning them. Well, I shall be a flame like that.
I'm sorry to disappoint the poor little worms, but the last of me shall be the flame in the burning bush. Whenever you see the flame, Jennifer, that will be me. Promise me that I shall be burned.
Oh, if I might be with you, Louis.
No! No, you must always be in the garden when the bush flames. You are my hold on the world. You are my immortality. Promise.
You know that I promise.
Well, that's about all. Except that you are to hang my pictures in the one-man show. I can trust your eyes. You won't let anyone else touch them.
You can trust me.
Then there's nothing more to worry about, is there? Oh, I'm fearfully tired. But if I stop talking, I shan't begin again. I say, B.B., do you think anything would stop you talking?
He confuses me with you, Paddy. Poor fellow. Poor fellow.
I used to be awfully afraid of death. But now it's come to it, I have no fear. I'm perfectly happy.
Stay with me, Louis. Don't leave me, dearest.
With all my faults, I don't think I've ever been really selfish. No artist can. Art is too large for that. You will marry again, Jennifer.
Oh, how can you, Louis?
Yes, yes, because people who have found marriage happy always marry again. I shan't be jealous. But don't talk to the other fella too much about me. He won't like it. I shall be your lover all the time, but it will be a secret from him. Poor devil.
Now come. You've talked enough. Try to rest a while.
Yes, I'm fearfully tired. But I shall have a long rest presently. Oh, I have something to say to you fellows. You're all here, aren't you? I'm too weak to see anything but Jennifer's bosom. Oh, that promises rest.
We are all here.
Well, that voice sounded devilish. Take care, Ridgeon. My ears hear things that other people's ears can't. I've been thinking. I'm cleverer than you imagine.
You've got on his nerves, Collie. Slip out quietly.
Would you deprive the dying actor of his audience?
I heard that, Ridgeon. That was good. Jennifer. Yes. Jennifer, dear, be kind to Ridgeon always. Because he was the last man who amused me.
Was I?
But it's not true. It's you who are still on the stage. I'm halfway home already.
What did you say, Sir Colenso?
Oh, it's nothing, my dear. Only one of those little secrets the men keep among themselves. Well, all you chaps have thought pretty hard things of me and said them.
No, no, Dupedet, not at all.
Yes, you have. I know what you all think of me. Don't imagine I'm sore about it. I forgive you.
Well, damn me. I beg your pardon.
That was old Walpole, I know. Don't grieve, Walpole. I'm perfectly happy. I'm not in pain. I don't want to live. I've escaped from myself. I'm in heaven, immortal in the heart of my beautiful Jennifer. I'm not afraid. I'm not ashamed. I know that in an accidental sort of way, struggling through the unreal part of life, I haven't always been able to live up to my ideal. But in my own real world, I have never done anything wrong, never denied my faith, never been untrue to myself. I've been threatened and blackmailed, insulted and starved, but I've played the game. I fought the good fight. And now it's all over. There's an indescribable peace. I believe in Michelangelo, Velasquez, and Rembrandt, in the might of design, the mystery of color, the redemption of all things by beauty everlasting, and the message of art that has made these hands blessed. Amen. Amen.
Louis, are you...
Not yet, dear. Very nearly, but not yet. I should like to rest my head on your bosom. Only it would tire you.
Oh, no, no, darling. How could you tire me?
Oh, that's good. That's real.
Don't spare me, dear. Lean on me with your weight.
Ginny Gwynny, I think I shall recover after all.
Yes, yes, you shall.
Because I certainly want to sleep. Just an ordinary sleep.
Yes, dear. Sleep.
Let me put him back on the pillow, ma'am. He'll be better so.
Oh, no, please, please, Doctor. He's not tiring me, and he will be so hurt when he wakes if he finds I have put him away.
He will never wake again.
Was that death?
Yes.
Will you wait for me a moment? I will come back.
Ought we to follow her? Is she in her right senses?
Oh, yes. She's all right. Leave her alone. She'll come back.
Let us get this thing out of the way before she comes.
My dear Collie, the poor lad, he died splendidly.
Aye, that's how the wicked die. No matter, it's not for us to judge. He's in another world now.
Borrowing his first £5 note there, probably.
I said the other day that the most tragic thing in the world is a sick doctor. I was wrong. The most tragic thing in the world is a man of genius who is not also a man of honour.
Poor young fellow. How well he died.
When you're as old as I am, you'll know that it matters very little how a man dies. What matters is how he lives.
No, please, Paddy, don't be hard on the poor lad. Not now. Not now. After all, was he so bad? He had only two failings, money and women. Well, let us be honest. Tell the truth, Paddy. Don't be hypocritical, Ridgeon. Throw off the mask, Walpole. Are these two matters so well arranged at present that a disregard of the usual arrangements indicates real depravity?
I don't mind his disregarding the usual arrangements. Confound the usual arrangements. What I mind is his disregarding everything except his own pocket and his own fancy. Do you suppose he'd have hesitated to blackmail me if I'd compromised myself with his wife? Not he.
Now, don't waste your time wrangling over him. A blackguard's a blackguard. An honest man's an honest man. And neither of them will ever be at a loss for a religion or a morality to prove that their ways are the right ways.
Well, perhaps. Still, De mortuis nil nisi bonum. He died extremely well, remarkably well. He has set us an example. Let us endeavour to follow it rather than harp on the weaknesses that have perished with him. I think it is Shakespeare who says that the good that most men do lives after them. The evil lies interred with their bones. Yes, interred with their bones. Believe me, Paddy, we are all mortal. It is the common lot, Ridgeon. Say what you will, Walpole. Nature's debt must be paid. If it is not today, it will be tomorrow. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. After life's fitful fever, they sleep well. And like this insubstantial bourne from which no traveller returns, leave not a rack behind.
Baby.
Out, out, brief candle, for nothing canst thou to damnation add. The readiness is all.
Yes, Baby. Death makes people go on like that. I don't know why it should, but it does. By the way, what are we going to do? Ought we to clear out? Or had we better wait and see whether Mrs. Dubedat will come back?
I think we'd better go.
I'm so sorry to have kept you waiting. I felt I must change.
Oh, not mentioned,
madam. Doesn't matter in the least.
I must shake hands with his friends before we part today. We have shared a great privilege and a great happiness, and that gives us a common faith, a common ideal that nobody else can quite have. Life will always be beautiful to us. May we shake hands on that?
Remember, all letters had better be left to your solicitor. Let him open everything and settle everything. That's the law, you know.
Oh, thank you. I didn't know.
Goodbye. I blame myself. I should have insisted on operating.
I will send the proper people. They will know what to do. You shall have no trouble. Goodbye, my dear lady.
Goodbye.
I said his friends, Sir Colenso.
One of the smaller Bond Street picture galleries, the walls covered with Dubedat's works. Jennifer, beautifully dressed and apparently very happy and prosperous, comes in.
Have the catalogues come yet, Mr. Danby?
Not yet.
But the private view will begin in less than half an hour.
I'd better run over to the printers to hurry them up.
Oh, if you would be so good, Mr. Danby. I'll take your place while you're away.
We have a few people who like to come before the crowd. People who really buy. And, of course, we are glad to see them. Hmm? Oh, the advance copies of your book have come.
Oh, give it to me. Oh, excuse me a moment. I'd like to look at it quietly in the office.
Yes. Good morning. May I look round as usual before the door's open?
Certainly, Sir Colenso. I'm sorry the catalogues haven't come. Here's my own list.
Oh, thanks. How's the book?
An advance copy of Mrs. Dubedat's Life of Her Late Husband.
The Story of a King of Men by his wife. You knew him here, I suppose.
Oh, we knew him. Better than she did, Sir Colenso, in some ways, perhaps.
So did I.
I'm just going to see about the catalogue.
I'll take a look round.
Clever brute.
Oh. Oh, I beg your pardon. I thought I was alone.
I'm glad we have met, Sir Colenso Ridgeon. I met Dr. Blenkinsop yesterday. I congratulate you on a wonderful cure. He looked the picture of health and strength and prosperity.
He has been fortunate.
Very fortunate. His life has been spared.
I mean that he's been made a medical officer of health. He cured the chairman of the Borough Council very successfully.
With your medicines?
No. I believe it was with a pound of ripe greengages.
Funny.
Yes. Life does not cease to be funny when people die, any more than it ceases to be serious when people laugh.
Dr. Blenkinsop said one very strange thing to me.
What was that?
He said the private practice in medicine ought to be put down by law. When I asked him why, he said the private doctors were ignorant, licensed murderers.
That is what the public doctor always thinks of the private doctor. Well, Blenkinsop ought to know. He was a private doctor long enough himself. Come. You have talked at me long enough. Talk to me. There is reproach in your face, in your voice. You are full of it. Out with it.
When I turned and saw you just now, I wondered how you could come here coolly to look at his pictures. You answered the question. To you, he was only a clever brute.
Oh, you know, I did not know you were here.
Oh, as if it could touch me or touch him. Don't you see that what is really dreadful is that to you, living things have no souls?
The soul is an organ I have not come across in the course of my anatomical work.
If you dissected me, you could not find my conscience. Do you think I have got none?
I have met people who had none.
Clever brutes?
I made no mistake about him.
Have you forgotten that he died?
Oh, he is not dead. He is there in those pictures and here in this book.
Put that down. How dare you touch it?
Oh. I'm very sorry. I see that I had better go.
I beg your pardon. I forgot myself, but it is not yet. It is a private copy.
But for me, it would have been a very different book.
But for you, it would have been a longer one.
You know then that I killed him?
Oh, Doctor, if you acknowledge that, if you realize what you have done, then there is forgiveness. I trusted in your strength instinctively at first. Then I thought I had mistaken callousness for strength. But if it was really strength, and if it was only such a mistake as we all make sometimes, it will make me so happy to be friends with you again.
I tell you, I made no mistake. I cured Blenkinsop. Was there any mistake there?
He recovered. Oh, don't be foolishly proud, Doctor. Confess to a failure and save our friendship. Remember, Sir Ralph gave Louis your medicine, and it made him worse.
I can't be your friend on false pretenses. The truth must come out. I used that medicine myself on Blenkinsop. It did not make him worse. It is a dangerous medicine. It cured Blenkinsop. It killed Louis Dubedat. When I handle it, it cures. When another man handles it, it kills. Sometimes.
Then why did you let Sir Ralph give it to Louis?
I did it because I was in love with you.
In love? You? An elderly man?
Dubedat, thou art revenged. I never thought of that. I suppose I appear to you a ridiculous old fogey.
But surely you must be at least 20 years older than I am.
More, perhaps. In 20 years you will understand how little difference that makes.
But how could you think that I, his wife, could ever think of you?
Yes, 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 yes. I quite understand. You needn't rub it in.
But it is only dawning on me now. Do you dare to tell me that it was to gratify a miserable jealousy that you deliberately... You murdered him.
I think I did. It really comes to that. Thou shalt not kill, but needs not strive officiously to keep alive. I suppose, yes, I killed him.
And you tell me that to my face, callously. You are not afraid.
I am a doctor. I have nothing to fear. It is not an indictable offence to call in B.B. Perhaps it ought to be, but it isn't.
I meant afraid of taking the law into my own hands and killing you.
You would always remember me if you did that.
I shall remember you always as a little man who tried to kill a great one.
Pardon me. I succeeded.
No. Doctors think they hold the keys of life and death, but it is not their will that is fulfilled. I don't believe you made any difference at all.
Perhaps not, but I intended to.
And you tried to destroy that wonderful and beautiful life merely because you grudged him a woman whom you could never have expected to care for.
Who believed in me. Who told me her friendship lasted until death.
And whom you were betraying.
No, whom I was saving.
Pray, Doctor, from what?
From making a terrible discovery. From having your life laid waste.
How?
No matter. I have saved you. I have been the best friend you ever had. You are happy, you are well. His works are an imperishable joy and pride for you.
And you think that is your doing? Oh, Doctor, Doctor, how can you be so silly? You did not paint those pictures which are my imperishable joy and pride. You did not speak the words that will always be heavenly music in my ears. I listen to them now whenever I am tired or sad. That is why I am always happy.
Yes, now that he is dead, were you always happy when he was alive?
Oh, you are cruel, cruel. When he was alive, I worried meanly about little things. I was unkind to him. I was unworthy of him. Oh, don't insult me. Don't blaspheme.
Oh, this is too monstrous. We cruel doctors have kept the secret from you faithfully, but it is like all secrets. It will not keep itself. The buried truth germinates and breaks through to the light.
What truth?
What truth? Why, that Louis Dubedat, king of men, was the most entire and perfect scoundrel, the most callously selfish blackguard that ever made a wife miserable.
He made his wife the happiest woman in the world, Doctor.
No. By all that's true on earth, he made his widow the happiest woman in the world. But it was I who made her a widow. And her happiness is my justification and my reward. Now you know what I did, and what I thought of him. Be as angry with me as you like. At least you know me as I really am.
I'm not angry with you any more, Sir Colenso. I knew quite well that you did not like Louis, but it is not your fault. You don't understand, that is all. I know quite well what you mean by his selfishness. He sacrificed everything for his art. In a certain sense, he had even to sacrifice everybody.
Everybody except himself. By keeping that back, he lost the right to sacrifice you and gave me the right to sacrifice him, which I did.
I can't argue with you. You are so utterly, so wildly wrong, so incapable of appreciating Louis.
Oh, I have marked 5 pictures as sold to me.
Well, they will not be sold to you. Louis's creditors insisted on selling them, but this is my birthday, and they were all bought in for me this morning by my husband.
By whom?
By my husband.
What husband? Whose husband? Which husband? Do you mean to say that you have married again?
Do you forget that Louis disliked widows, and that people who have married happily once always marry again?
Then I have committed a purely disinterested murder.
Just got the first batch of catalogues in time. The doors are open.
So glad you like the pictures, Sir Colenso. Good morning.
Good morning.
In The Doctor's Dilemma by Bernard Shaw, Derek Godfrey played the part of Sir Colenso Ridgeon, Sarah Burdell, Jennifer Dubedat, Gary Bond, Louis Dubedat, Stephen Murray, Bloomfield Bonington, Cyril Luckham, Sir Patrick Cullen, and Hugh Manning, Cutler Walpole. Dr. Blenkinsop was played by Robert Trotter, Leo Schutzmacher, John Gabriel, Minnie Tinwell, Francis Jeter, Emmy, Margot Boyd, Redpenny and Mr. Danby, Tim Brierley, the newspaper man, and the narrator, Peter Wickham. The play was directed by John Tiedemann.